Hi, I'm Matt Stone. You're listening to Crucial Conversations, a series of five stories of grassroots leadership by people in the disability sector in Queensland.
What drives me in my change and advocacy is about belonging and relationships.
In the fifth and last podcast in this series on grassroots leadership, we hear from Kevin Cox.
The first thing that those institutional arrangements attack is your relationships.
Not afraid to move out of his comfort zone, Kevin has been active in cutting many new paths for himself and on behalf of all people with disability.
That stuff that happens that no one can explain, can't be planned for, but it happens.
When Kevin acquired his disability in his early 20s, he would not have expected that in the following decades he would become engaged in disability advocacy, co-found an innovative service, win a class action to change the Australian Building Code, or serve as Queensland's Anti-Discrimination Commissioner for 7 years. He has taken a lead, but has not done this alone, and is clear that the most effective leaders are connected to others. Kevin is very clear that his passion for standing up for people stemmed from the values learnt in his childhood in Western Queensland. In this podcast, he reflects on the place and experience of people with disability in our communities and what we all lose when we exclude vulnerable people.
I understood what people feared from me. And you could see in people's eyes the fear, and why people didn't want you to be part of society and wanted you locked away in institutions was because what I represented was their own vulnerability. My name's Kevin Cox. I was born on the 8th of May 1960 in Mitchell, 2 hours north of the New South Wales border. I was born in the Mitchell Hospital. At that point, there was a number of unfortunate circumstances that led to my mother's death. She ended up dying from her heart gave way. I really had a good life. My grandparents, my mother's parents raised me. I did everything that every other child in the bush did. Learned to ride a horse when I was 2 or 3. My father taught me, and we had to learn to ride bareback before we could use a saddle. I fell off a few times, like most kids. My grandparents had a son who was only 4 years older than me, and we grew up together like siblings. It was clear that he was my uncle because he had a different surname to me. Growing up on stations and in the bush, we were just like brothers. I think it's fair to say my father probably struggled with the loss of my mother. He sold a property and over time lost his way, and we became estranged. Last time I saw my father was my 8th birthday, and he came back into my life when I was about 32. We made contact, and then a couple of years later he contracted bowel cancer, and he came to live with myself and my auntie, and he died in my current home in Brisbane. At that time I was coordinator of a disability service, and I suppose I was trying to impress him and say, you know, I had quite a big budget. And he said to me, money's nothing. It's about friendship. It's about the people. It's about relationships. And it's about looking out for those who are vulnerable. In our world, vulnerability is a sign of weakness. What I've learned, vulnerability is a sign of strength. Women had a huge influence in my life. My grandmother and my aunties, because my grandfather was away a lot shearing. But my grandfather had a very different influence in my life, and he would sit down and explain and rationalise with you. And in some ways, through his metaphors, would tell stories, which was really about your moral compass, what was right, what was wrong. He went to the University of Life, and he used to describe me as a bull in a china shop, because I wanted everything to happen quickly. And I remember one day he said, go and get that bucket and fill it with water. He said, then put your hand in there and stir around like mad. And after about 5 minutes, he said, take it out. And he said, what do you got? And I said, a bucket of water. He said, yes. He said, all of your mad wanting to get everything done quickly, you can put a lot of energy into stuff, but it doesn't change. A couple of Aboriginal women used to come across with kids who were my age, and we'd play and they'd buy fruit and veggies. And one day my grandfather said, oh, I'm going to pick up Mrs. So-and-so, and I can't remember her name now, because she's got to take the boy that I used to play with to Toowoomba to see a doctor, and we're going to give them a lift to catch a bus. And he said, would you like to come? And I said, yes. And so it was my first exposure to the way we excluded and marginalised and treated Aboriginal people as non-citizens. And I later learnt this camp, which was across the river from us, was called Hollywood. When we pulled up, I was looking for the houses, but there were no houses. There were water tanks cut in half. There were car bonnets and the odd tin shed. The young boy came out of the car bonnet with a couple of siblings. Mum and Dad came out of a half-cut water tank and with a bag packed, and that's where they lived. We can strip away the false status, the false hierarchical institutional privilege. When we strip that away, we can see each other for the good that we all hold within our being.
So what was happening around the time of the accident?
I was in Dalby. I was working on the wheat board, playing football with a group of friends, and starting to think about the future of my life. Not long before my 21st, I'd looked at a block of land. I thought, like most young men, I used to buy cars and have fast cars, pack slow racehorses, and not save much money. But I always had this belief that when I was about 25, I'd probably find the girl of my life. And that came to fruition after I'd my accident, of course. And I'm still with that girl.
Okay, so step us through the accident.
I was living in Dalby and I was playing for a team. They're called Waratahs. We're playing against St George, out at St George. There was a scrum and we were packed too far apart. And normally when that was the case, I used to just stand up, but for that day I didn't. And the scrum broke up and I fell to the ground. And all I could feel was my head and nothing else. had to wait for the flying doctors to come. It was late in the afternoon. I was conscious all the way. We got to Brisbane and it was dark. Ambulance from the airport to the PA hospital. I don't know whether I dreamt it or it was real, but at the end of the bed there was a white light, and it was my mother. And she said, "You'll be all right." And that was it. That's stuff that happens that no one can explain, can't be planned for, but it happens. And there's been a lot of that in my family life. The most profound thing that happened in my accident, it was like thrusting their hand into my chest and stealing my soul, my identity, and replacing it with the diagnosis of a C5, C6 quadriplegic. I no longer was a citizen. I was seen to be a burden. But I remember when I got discharged, a couple of mates come and said, "Well, we're going to the pub. You're coming with us." So obviously I got a bit socially excited and fell out of my wheelchair. And nothing happened. I didn't break anything. I didn't end up with a pressure sore. And that was the greatest thing, because it took away that institutional indoctrination of not taking risks, because I was a risk taker, but a calculated risk taker, I think. What drives me in my change and advocacy is about belonging and relationships. And it's about what we have in common. And we all need to belong. It's not driven by fear, it's driven by hope. Ever since 9/11, fear's driven this world. My uncle and auntie and I, we went halves in buying a 10-acre property at the base of the Bunya Mountains in a little town called McLagan. And we were living there for 2 years. But I knew my life wasn't going anywhere. So again, I took a risk and I put myself into the Dalby Hospital. The first thing that those institutional arrangements attack is your relationships, whether they're your family or a friend, and particularly somebody who might be a very valued citizen. Because if you have a relationship with somebody that doesn't fit the stereotype, then you're challenging the whole system of that institution. Then there's the identity that the institution bestows upon you. And that identity is driven through power and politics, because it serves those people's interest for your identity to be one that is not fully human, devalued, because their interests are going to be served in one way or another.
This series is brought to you by CREW, the Community Resource Unit. CREW exists to create positive change so that people with disability will be welcomed, respected and appreciated in their communities. For more information, please visit our website at cru.org.au. We'd love to hear your feedback on CREW's Facebook page, or send us an email via crew@crew.org.au. This series is available on iTunes and wherever good podcasts are found. If you have enjoyed this crucial conversation, we'd appreciate your sharing this important series and helping it reach a broader audience. For more information, go to crew.org.au/crucialconversations.
Commonwealth Rehab was being liberated, and in turn, people who were going through it were being liberated. The things that were changing was that the Hawke government had been elected, and the handicapped persons program was being reviewed. The Disability Services Act of 1986 would evolve from that review. And this was in 1985. So I went back to the Commonwealth Rehab in Thuringia. And before that, it was an institution. And ironically, it was run by a bloke called Rudy Corporal. It was, you know, run along military lines. Up until then, many people with disabilities, one service had total control of your life. And there were men there who were in their 60s who had hurt themselves on property, and they were being rehabilitated, being institutionalised, losing dignity, losing your autonomy.
What was it like stepping into that institution and knowing that you were putting your future in the hands of other people?
What drove me to that was my future was in the hands of other people, and it was people who had been trained in social work, in the medical model, and that wasn't where I saw my future. And so I knew I had to take control of my life. It's a bit like the old saying, if you want a job done properly, you do it yourself. And obviously, manual physical labour I was no longer able to do, so I had to revert to using my brain. Well, from 1985, I met my partner. I moved to Brisbane. I enrolled into Castledine College of Advanced Education, and I studied residential care, which turned into social science. There was a group being formed. It's now known as Queensland Advocacy Incorporated. And from there, I was really fortunate to meet people with disabilities, family members, individual members of society who were strongly about the rights of people with disabilities and empowering people with disabilities to take control of their lives. So QAI got funded. I ended up being the treasurer on the committee. We employed three staff, and we were the first legal systemic advocacy organisation funded in Queensland. I saw QAI as bringing people who had intellectual disability, physical disability, mental illness together because of our common exclusion and oppression and denial of our citizenship and basic human rights. People with intellectual disabilities were so insightful about institutions and could tell you stories that grounded you and were powerful and stoked the fire in your belly to address the injustices. My first job was working for Intellectual Disability Services, an institution in itself. My role was community liaison officer. It was about building connections with people still living in the institution to think about moving out. But I was only there 6 months because at the same time I was writing a submission to establish a self-run directed organisation called Lifestyle Options. Lifestyle Options was small. It was run by the people who used the service, and it was individualised. So people chose how they wanted to run it. they didn't want to hire people, they didn't have to, but they could do the whole lot or as little as possible. It was the first of its kind in Australia, I'm led to believe. I negotiated with the federal department that each individual had a certain number of hours that they needed, and it was to their name. They had their number of hours, individual workers, it could do their pays, but it'd also give them each fortnight a record of how many hours they've used and what they had left. We'd also work together to make policies around how the organisation was run, and I deliberately looked to have people there who had intellectual disabilities and quite severe intellectual disabilities, because again my belief was you set up systems so that it was all around the individual, but it's what we call now supported decision making. I was collecting people on the way to be the consumers, as it were, I hated that word, of the service. So when we put this submission in, I met with a person from Canberra who ran disability services, and he said, we've been waiting for 2 years for a submission like this. It was what the Disability Services Act was about human rights, about liberating people, about people having choice and control. I was starting to lobby around transport because I was working. There were 8 taxis in Brisbane, accessible to cabs. 25% of the train stations were accessible and none of the buses. You know, my first job was out at Ipswich and I lived in Tringa. You know, I had to catch a train from Toowong. So I had to leave home before 7 o'clock, because otherwise I wouldn't have got a taxi. Get to Toowong, go to work, come back. And then I became the coordinator of Consumers Health Advocacy Queensland, which was a systemic advocacy organisation for health consumers. That was about advocating for the health consumer to be treated with rights, and particularly those who were more vulnerable. We were only funded for 2 years until the change of government, and then we got defunded because we took on the AMA and the Health Rights Commission at the time, the very powerful organisations who didn't want to be held accountable. I became director of Queensland Advocacy Incorporated, and I was there for a bit over 12 years. The not-for-profit hostel industry, I found evidence of people being bought and sold. It was Queen's birthday weekend and I went into work and there were 8 people with obvious intellectual disabilities, impoverished, standing outside of QAI's office door, and they escaped from a hostel in Ipswich. To cut a long story short, this woman went back in because she told me about how the owner of the hostel wanted $18,000 each for these people. So she went in with a tape recorder and recorded this conversation. It was costing less than $2 a day to feed people. They spent $800 a week on food. Many vulnerable people, all didn't have disabilities. Some were alcoholic, some were drug addicts. So these private-for-profit hostels were all about profit. Hostel owners would buy people with disabilities and they'd sell them. Big money. We got 2 pieces of legislation developed, the Residential Services Act and the Accommodation Act, which regulated hostels and boarding houses. Queensland was the last state to have legislation brought in to regulate. After that, I was then the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner of Queensland for 7 years. It was about social cohesion. It was about empowering communities to take control of dealing with the issues that they had. But it was really about inclusiveness and about struggling with that question, what does it mean to belong to this community? I understood what it was like to be a white privileged man, but I tried to use it in a constructive way as opposed to a destructive force. We worked a lot with the police and the Muslim community and the AFP. I had a great team. I worked with great people in the community, in the government. When the Newman government was cutting left, right and centre, I put out a press release saying short-term gain but long-term pain, and which was basically calling on them to do cost-benefit analysis. That was a privilege to work in the Anti-Discrimination Commission in a statutory authority that gave me a mandate to really push human rights in Queensland. I suppose I had to really be careful about my role as an activist, because I couldn't be an activist. It was clearly told to me, yet there was advocacy, no doubt, in my mind to do, but it's about how you position that. My case, Cox versus the State of Queensland, which was a convention centre, most significant case that Justice Atkinson oversaw, the enormity of that case. I knew in my heart that, yes, it proved that the Australian Building Code was discriminatory and it had to be changed. And symbolically, it said people with disabilities had to enter the front door of buildings and not the back door. Now I'm at Transport as the Executive General Manager of the Accessible Transport Network. And my job is there to make accessibility as business as usual for all of transport. So it's about inclusion, because transport, like housing, are the cornerstones of people to be able to participate in the economic and social infrastructure of society.
Leadership doesn't occur in isolation. And I pick on a quote, behind every great man stands a greater woman. The moral of this quote suggests to me that leaders have support of people around them who believe in them and provide the opportunities for leadership to develop. This requires leaders to be able to listen and understand people.
Leadership is about integrity. It's about having a vision for the world that you want to live in. It's about respecting people of different views, trying to understand somebody with a different viewpoint, because I believe that there's a kernel of truth in everyone's worldview. The challenge is to peel away the layers of the onion to understand what that kernel of truth is. The system is there, and you poke it a bit here, and you might poke it there. Over here, something will happen that is the unintended consequences, which could be positive or could be negative. So when we're trying to change a system or operate in a change environment within a system, it's just an ongoing challenge. This story is about belonging, about relationships, about being human, and understanding what that means for me and what it might mean for my neighbour.
This podcast was funded by the Anne Cross Leadership Initiative, Established in 2017 to honour the contribution of Anne Cross to Uniting Care Queensland during her years as the Chief Executive Officer, this partnership between Uniting Care and CRU aims to contribute to the development of strong, principled leadership amongst people with disability and families throughout Queensland, in order to contribute to better lives for people with disability.